This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. This month, Locus Focus presents a series of programs inspired by a new book from the Foundation for Deep Ecology and the Post-Carbon Institute. It's called Energy, Overdevelopment and the Delusion of Endless Growth. Energy takes an unflinching look at the systems that support our insatiable thirst for more power, along with their unintended consequences. This morning, we talk with Richard Heinberg, who has contributed two articles to the collection. Together, these articles look at the intersection of peak oil and the need for immediate energy conservation. Richard Heinberg is the author of 10 books, including The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality, Peak Everything, Waking Up to the Century of Declines, and The Party's Over, Oil War and the Fate of Industrial Societies. Richard, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Good to be with you, Barbara.
It's good to have you back. Yes, I think the last time we talked was right after The End of Growth came out. Yeah. And so this new book that you've contributed to, and I guess not just the two articles, but I think you also wrote one of the introductions or forewords to it, looks to me like a kind of a compendium of everything you've ever thought about, you and a lot of other people.
Well, this is a giant book. Just the physical imposing reality of the book is pretty remarkable. These things are called coffee table books, but this one is like, I think if you put four legs on it, it'll be a coffee table by itself. It has lots of color photos, including big two-page color spreads that really show what energy production actually looks like, and it's in most cases it's not a pretty picture. And the book also is an effort to bring together basic information about energy, where it comes from, how it works, how we use it, what its real costs are. It's an effort to bring more energy literacy to the debate, and we believe that this is the most important subject there is on the planet right now. Basically, all of our most critical problems intersect in the energy sphere right now, whether it's environmental with climate change, which is a result of our current energy policies of burning fossil fuels, or whether it's the economy, which runs on energy. You know, take away oil and electricity and the economy doesn't slow down, it goes away. Or whether it's geopolitics, war and peace. It's really all about energy. And until we get energy sorted out, these problems are not going away.
Well, last night I pulled off a book from my bookshelf, kind of a dusty book called The Lean Years by Richard Barnett, which came out in 1980. And I started looking at it again because that was one of the books that I was reading back now, I guess it's like 32 years ago, when there was a lot of discussion back in the 70s as a result of the oil embargo in 1973 and all kinds of other oil crises that happened throughout that decade. And it was interesting to see how far the discussions come from back in 1980 when Richard Barnett was one of the lead thinkers on the fact that we are running out of all these resources. But it made me think about how much people talked about it back then. And then it seemed to be coincident with the election of Ronald Reagan at the end of 1980. People stopped thinking about it and talking about it. And I wonder how you see a difference in the conversation and the urgency of these issues now compared to what was going on in the 70s. And then add on to that question, how would things be different if the conversation hadn't stopped for so many years?
Yeah, good question. Well, in the 1970s, we had a spate of remarkable books and reports and the development of environmental laws and organizations. It was an extraordinary decade. Of course, we had the Clean Water, Clean Air Act, the Limits to Growth Report. I could go on and on. And it was not just coincidentally a time of energy shortages. That got people's attention. We realized that we were on an unsustainable path with regard to energy. In the 1980s, what happened was, as a result of some oil discoveries in the 70s when prices were high, we had the North Sea oil, Britain and Norway primarily, discoveries in Alaska came online, and a few others. And as a result, oil prices in the 1980s plummeted back down to historic low levels. Everyone effectively went back to sleep, and instead of pursuing a path toward energy efficiency and alternative renewable energy sources, we embraced even more deeply our reliance on dependency on fossil fuels. Through the 90s, we still enjoyed cheap energy, and now in the 2000s, we're back in this period of problematic energy supply. Of course, there's an enormous debate in the energy industry about peak oils. You know, when is it going to happen? Has it been delayed by hydrofracking and new technology? But the reality is, oil prices are historically at a very high level right now, about five times what they were just 10 years ago. Higher than they were in inflation-adjusted terms than in the 1970s during the oil shocks. World oil production hasn't advanced since 2005, even at these very high prices. So the oil industry has changed, and the global economy has changed as well. The world economy has stagnated largely because of high energy prices. Of course, there are other things going on as well. Their over-reliance on debt over the past 40 years is finally catching up with us, and I'm here talking about primarily consumer debt, household debt. But the energy situation is really at the heart of the slowing economic activity, primarily in the older industrial nations like the U.S. and Europe. So we're in another moment like the 1970s, only this time I think it's extremely unlikely that we will see the same kind of supply response that we saw in the 1980s that drove energy prices back down again. This time I think we're in a permanent transition period, transition away from fossil fuels, permanent until we actually finish that transition, until fossil fuels are no longer part of the energy mix.
Well, there's another issue here, too, that I think is thrown into the mix, and that's climate change. And actually, back in the 70s, there were people who were talking about climate change as being a really urgent concern. But then I think we went through a mini ice age or something somewhere around 1972, got colder for a while, and people forgot about that there was climate change as an issue. But how does climate change maybe put the brakes on even more than we had in the 70s? It's not just a concern about the scarcity of these resources, the cost of extracting the more difficult-to-reach resources, but how does climate change also make us rethink whether we should be putting any energy at all into developing hydrocarbon fuels?
Right. Well, in the 70s, climate change was pretty much theoretical. I mean, the basic logic was very sound and obviously sound that, you know, if we keep putting more carbon dioxide, methane, and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, then the Earth will warm and it will create unstable climatic conditions and so on. Well, now it's no longer theoretical. We're watching this unfold in front of our eyes. year after year, we're seeing record temperatures. We're seeing weather events occurring that are, should be once in a century, now are happening every 2, 3, 5 years. Floods, fires, hurricanes, and especially droughts and heat waves. So these are, again, these are not just theoretical, and they're having economic impact, and it's a spiraling economic impact. If you just trace out a few years down the line the current trajectory of increasing costs from climate change, within just years or at the most a very few decades, those costs will overwhelm the economic growth that we're even currently seeing in the world's nations. So this is a problem that world leaders can't ignore any longer. Of course, American politicians are doing their best to continue doing so, but even in this country, I think we're getting close to the point where for reasons of economic security as well as environmental security, climate change is going to have to be factored into our energy planning.
Well, this morning we're talking with Richard Heinberg, who has contributed a couple articles to a new coffee table book, actually probably a coffee table that is a book, called Energy Overdevelopment and the Delusion of Endless Growth. And we're talking specifically about, we'll probably talk about this whole gamut of things, but Richard in particular is known as an expert on peak oil, probably one of the people who popularized that term so that almost everybody uses it, but probably not that many people really understand what it is. So before we move on to what I really like to look at is like that intersection of peak oil and the need to conserve, which you write, right. Those are your two articles in this book. Let's really explain what peak oil is, and what is peak oil, and are we there yet?
Right. Well, peak oil is basically the observation that extracting a non-renewable resource like petroleum occurs in phases. In the early phase, it's easy to ramp up production, just drill more wells. But you eventually get to a point with regard to any oil field or oil-producing nation where it's simply no longer possible to continue increasing the rate at which oil is extracted. And we've seen this happen in country after country around the world, most notably here in the U.S., where our national oil production peaked in 1970. And it's not as though it's a steady ramp downward. Some years are better than others. Back in the 1980s, as I mentioned earlier, we gained access to the oil of North Slope of Alaska, and that provided us with a number of years of increasing oil production. But we never got quite back up to that peak rate of production that we saw in 1970, and then Alaska started to decline. Currently, oil production from Alaska is in steep decline. Same thing with Gulf of Mexico. And so the same thing is going to happen for the world as a whole. There's no question about that. It's only a problem of when world oil production will peak. And we have some pretty good evidence that we're in that peaking period right now. Again, as I mentioned, world crude oil production has been flatlined since 2005, even in the context of very high oil prices. So that's a pretty good clue that we're very close to that global oil production peak. And the reason this is a big deal is that oil is currently our foremost energy source on the planet, and it provides the liquid fuel for virtually all transportation and all trade. In turn, relies on transport, whether it's by rail or ship or truck or airplane. So peak oil has the potential to undermine the global economy. If we don't proactively reduce our reliance on oil and rethink our transport system, then we're going to see the 21st century be essentially a mirror image of the 20th century, as the 20th century was all about increasing energy consumption, increasing trade, and growing economies. The 21st century, again, if we don't plan for this, will look like declining energy, declining economies, and increasing environmental risks and costs.
Well, are there arguments still being made that peak oil is really not an issue because we can exploit these, what they're called now, non-conventional sources of oil, whether it's tar sands or it's shale oil, or and then there's also something called oil shale, I guess, which is different from shale oil. But these things that were, in fact, Richard Barnett in 1980 was making references to these different sources, and they had a different name for them then, but they were, as opposed to the proven fields, I forget what he called them, but they were the fields that hadn't been really tapped yet, and it came down to, we really don't know how to do it. Well, now we do know how to do it, but is it worth it?
Right. Well, this is the argument from the oil industry, and we're seeing this displayed for us in TV ads and print ads all over the place. It's making its way into the pages of the New York Times and Wall Street Journal and so on. So just about everybody has heard by now that hydrofracturing for oil and natural gas has been a game changer, that the U.S. is about to become, you know, the new Saudi Arabia of oil, and again, as because we used to be the world's foremost oil producer back in the early part of the 20th century. Well, there's a problem with all of this, which is that what we're going after with hydrofracturing, the lower grade resources, are more costly to produce. The only reason that people are going after this stuff now is because of higher prices. We had very high natural gas prices in the early 2000s that made hydrofracturing for natural gas economic temporarily. It's no longer economic because natural gas prices have gone back down, and so drilling is declining for shale gas. And over the next few years, we will see declining production and higher prices. Same thing has happened in the oil patch in the Bakken in North Dakota. Very high oil prices have led to the application of hydrofracturing technology in tight oil reservoirs in the Bakken and the Eagle Ford play in South Texas and elsewhere. But what we see in all of these unconventional plays is lower quality resources, very high decline rates. So drill a well in January, and the initial production rate may be relatively high, but by the end of December in the same year, production may be down by 60% or more. So that means that you have to keep drilling. In order to maintain the same rate of production or increase production, you have to drill and drill and drill. So we're turning America into a pincushion, in effect. We're not talking about a few hundred more wells. We're talking about tens and hundreds of thousands of new oil and gas wells in order to exploit these resources. And with the high decline rates, many of them are turning out to be not economic. The shale gas industry is in effect collapsing right now. With the tight oil, as in the Bakken and Eagle Ford, we're likely to see increasing production until about 2017, and then declines will start there. So we've bought ourselves effectively about 5 years of reprieve in declining oil and gas production in the U.S., and that's been ballyhooed as 100 years of cheap natural gas and decades of cheap oil. But that's not what we are actually seeing, and it's not what we will see. What we've been hearing from through the media is effectively a Wall Street bubble that is in the process of bursting. You know, the last Wall Street bubble was the housing bubble of the early 2000s. The current Wall Street bubble is the fracking boom, and Wall Street has pushed this mercilessly, and it's been destructive not only of many of the companies that have over-leveraged, and in order to keep their share prices up, they have overproduced. which simply has driven down the prices and made things worse in case of natural gas. But they've also, in the process of doing this, Wall Street has also warped America's energy policy, because instead of realistically seeing this as a five-year reprieve so that we could make other plans for alternative energy sources, they've convinced Americans that we have 100 years of cheap fossil fuel energy, and therefore we should just forget about climate change and become wealthy with this cheap energy. It's a lie. And it's unfortunately it's a very widespread lie that has again warped our energy policy.
Well, if it weren't a lie, would there be anything wrong with forgetting about climate change and just getting rich?
Well, of course. Yes, I mean, if it were true, if we did have 100 years of cheap natural gas and tight oil, then it would be a catastrophe for the climate. But, you know, if it's put simply as a choice between climate change on one hand and cheap energy and lots of economic growth on the other, it's pretty easy to persuade people to go for the economic growth and jobs. But the point is that's a false choice. The fossil fuel era is winding down. If we choose that path, we're not choosing economic opportunity and jobs and growth and all the rest. What we are choosing is to be shackled ever more firmly to an energy policy with no future.
Well, it seems you're talking about how the media and the oil and gas industry has really promoted fracking for natural gas and oil as the great new future, and it's what we should be doing. There has been some pushback in the small part of the media. A couple years ago, Josh Fox came out with his very well-received film, Gasland, which it was a very personal take on the gas shale boom in Pennsylvania, and then he followed it out to Wyoming and looked at some of the impacts on water tables and aquifers and some dangerous side effects it might have. And then more recently, Gus Van Sant's film Promised Land also takes on fracking, which got a lot of pushback from the oil and gas industry. I wonder, first of all, your take on both of those films and whether they are really accurately portraying what the issues are and what your thoughts are about how ferociously both of those films have been attacked by the oil and gas industry.
Yeah, I thought both films were excellent. Promised Land is actually a pretty accurate view of just how the industry goes about obtaining leases for drilling. And if you see that film, and I recommend everybody see it, of course, you can get a pretty good idea of what life is like in rural communities in Pennsylvania right now, where the company representatives, you know, just fan out through county after county, offering cash for the right to drill, and it pits neighbor against neighbor, because of course some folks need that lease money in order to pay the bills, and other folks are looking at the environmental risks and costs. That film actually didn't show what happens next, what happens when the trucks start rolling in, because for a single fracking gas well, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of 18-wheel tractor-trailer rig trips to bring in the drilling rig, to clear a football field-sized pad for exploration and drilling, bring in millions of gallons of water and chemicals for fracking, to truck away the wastewater, to truck away the drilling rig once that part of the operation is finished. And then what if something goes wrong? And that's what was covered in Josh Fox's film Gasland, because things do go wrong. We're talking about drilling a couple of kilometers underground and then another couple of kilometers horizontally in rock that's already fractured. And of course, if everything goes right, then the gas-bearing rock is thoroughly isolated from the water table, and there's no likelihood of chemicals being transported, you know, one way or the other. But the reality is geology is complicated, and we're talking about rock that's already naturally fractured, in which we're deliberately fracturing even further with high-pressure water and chemicals and sand and so on. So there is the possibility of water and chemicals, wastewater, seeping into water wells and water tables, particularly if there's a problem with well casing or cementing, which happens in a certain percentage of instances. So, you know, if we were only, again, talking about a few dozen or a few hundred of these wells, this might be a risk. We could say, well, in order, you know, to get that valuable natural gas, maybe it's a risk worth taking. But again, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of gas and oil wells. So the risks are very substantial. And I've spoken to people who have fracking gas rigs operating, you know, on neighboring land, and they told me about the air quality change, the change to water quality. One woman I was speaking to raises goats, and she's experiencing health problems with her herd as a result of fracking on nearby land. Now, it's hard to get confirmation on some of these things because very often the local authorities are, you know, they want to do what's right for the economy of the local area, or maybe there are economic interests that are making it hard for them to do their jobs properly in terms of regulating or even reporting these health problems or environmental problems. So it often ends up being the company's word against the people's word. So you have, you know, a relatively poor farmer or rancher going up against, you know, Chesapeake Energy or Devon Energy, and you know, who's the media going to believe?
Well, actually, a couple problems I have with both of those films. They're sort of the on either extreme of this debate about how dangerous this process really is. On the side of Gasland, it was criticized for confusing what gases like methane, which occur naturally in the ground, and confusing what's natural with what's been exacerbated by the process. And I understand that Joss Fox actually came out with a kind of appendix to his film to clarify that. So I think he is taking the science seriously and trying not to exaggerate it. On the part of Promised Land, I was frustrated that the Matt Damon character at the end said, well, it may be a problem, it may not, we don't really know. And that was not a real strong stand for that film to take.
Yeah, right.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, there's like another unconventional form of energy that I find personally very disturbing, and that's the tar sands extractions right. That are going on, well, most notably in Alberta, but I understand that they're starting them closer to home here in the States, too, in several different locations. I think in Utah's going to start doing some tar sands extraction, and I've heard about some others. So one thing that really kind of blew my mind about tar sands was when I learned that they were actually considering in Canada to build nuclear power facilities expressly to power the tar sands extractions, which is an indication of one of the things you talk about, which is the amount of energy it takes to extract the energy and at what point is it worth even doing.
Yeah. Right. One of the things we try to do in the book is, as I mentioned earlier, increase the reader's energy literacy. And there's some basic concepts that need to be part of the overall energy conversation that usually aren't. And one of these concepts is energy return on energy invested. It takes energy to get energy. And with fossil fuels in the early days of oil, the energy investment that was required was trivial. You know, you put 100 barrels of oil's worth of effort into exploration and production, and you'd get 1,000 barrels of oil or 10,000 barrels of oil back from that investment. Well, today, with these unconventional sources like the tar sands, the energy return on energy invested is much, much lower. That's why these forms of energy production only work with high prices. It's only because we have very high oil prices that that tar sands production works economically. But the tar sands in Alberta is a variable resource. In other words, there are sweet spots, and obviously they are going after the sweet spots first. And as those are depleted, even though the total resource there is very large, as the sweet spots are drained off, and as they move further out into the more problematic areas, the energy return on energy invested declines pretty substantially. Now we're talking about, even in the case of the most productive areas, the sweet spots, energy profit ratio of maybe 5 to 1. Now that might sound pretty good, you know, invest one barrel of oil, get 5 out. But actually, if you look at society as a whole and the energy it takes to make an industrial society work, we need better than 10 to 1 energy profit ratio to make it all work. So already tar sands are underperforming in that regard. I mean, if that were our only source of energy, we wouldn't be able to operate an industrial society. We can only do it because that energy is being effectively subsidized by other more abundant and cheaper sources of energy, like natural gas, which is used to cook the tar sands, or regular conventional oil, which we import from the Middle East. So what this boils down to is the tar sands are not as economic a resource and will not be as long-lasting a resource as we are being told. Once again, this is a bargain with the devil, both environmentally and economically. And it's really important that economic aspect of the equation be taken into account in the discussion. Because once again, if it's only a question of, you know, climate and the environment on one hand versus the economy and jobs on the other, most people will take the economy and jobs most of the time. But we have to understand it's a false choice. The tar sands are not going to be economic for very long, and so why even bother? Why should we even be bothering with this abysmally terrible resource when it's not just ruining the environment, but also upending our energy policy?
Well, we're talking this morning with Richard Heinberg, the author of many books about the ends of abundant energy resources as we know it, and he's currently contributed to a new book called Energy Overdevelopment and the Delusion of Endless Growth, which sort of, I think, in a way sums up your outlook towards what's going on. So in the remaining moments we have, I want to talk about some solutions that you see to this really horrible problem, because you're also a big advocate for conservation. So how does conservation intersect with the whole problem with peak oil and our fascination right now with so-called non-conventional sources of energy?
Right. Well, you know, we have gotten used to using energy at a prodigious rate, unlike any previous era in human history. I mean, the average American has like 150 energy slaves. If all of the services that are done for us on a daily basis, driving us around and heating our homes and all that, if all of that had to be done by muscle power, we would each have to have 150 people working for us day and night. Well, you know, we got used to using so much energy just because it was cheap and abundant, but that doesn't mean that scale of energy consumption is necessary in order to support a decent quality of life. Over the course of this century, we're going to have to get used to using less. And very few people in the energy world are willing to talk about that. A lot of people who are really knowledgeable, who have studied the problem, understand that that's actually true. But not many are willing to say it out loud. And I think it's important that we do start talking about this. Because unless we plan for using less energy, then it's going to come as a shock to our, not just our expectations, but also our economy. Now, we can do this in a couple of ways. We can do it through efficiency, just by doing what we're doing now, but like driving a more fuel-efficient car, for example, or using more energy-efficient light bulbs and so on. We're still getting exactly the same level of service, but we're investing less energy in the process. And we can do it by curtailment, which is just, you know, doing fewer things, not going for that car trip. Now, in fact, we're adapting by doing both, and I think we will have to do a lot of both efficiency and curtailment. Americans are driving less today than they were 5 years ago. Vehicle miles traveled per capita has declined in the U.S. for the first time since the early 20th century. That's really remarkable. Of course, that's partly because the economy is slower. Fewer people have jobs than would otherwise have right now if the economy hadn't tanked in 2008. So that's partly the explanation. But here again, you know, if we plan our lives so that we need fewer car trips, then we can have actually happier lives, because who wants to spend all their time in a car driving in traffic? We can have actually happier lives using less energy. That's what we should be aiming for. That's what we should be talking about right now.
Well, I think that some utility companies actually are starting to advocate conservation. I'm not sure if it's a nationwide trend, but here in Portland, our gas company, our electric company, and the Energy Trust of Oregon kind of are collaborating on. We consumers get a energy usage report card every few months, which lets you know how your energy use compares to your neighbors. And every time I get my report card, I'm appalled at how profligate we still are. But and there's issues. I mean, there's like, you have an old house, you're going to be having higher heating bills, and there's a lot. It costs money to insulate and change your windows and all those things. So there's, I think, some maybe government policies that we need to also be working for that would help people be able to afford some of the changes they need to make so they can actually consume less energy. But I wonder if you see some hopeful signs that it's not that all utility companies are no longer opposed to conservation.
Right. Well, in many cases, utility companies are finding that the costs of added generation capacity are so high that it's actually in their interest to promote conservation. The same thing that you mentioned is also true here in California, where I live with Pacific Gas and Electric. They have big energy conservation programs for consumers. Well, this is all well and good, but it's nibbling around the fringes so far, because what I'm talking about is not, you know, 3% or 5% reduction in overall energy use. Over the course of the next few decades, I think North America is probably going to see a greater than 50% decline in available energy. So we can adapt to that over time. There's no question. We in North America already use about twice as much energy per capita as Europeans do. So, you know, folks in France and Germany are not freezing in the dark. So we can do that. But it's going to take some planning, and it's going to take some effort, and the sooner we start that, the better.
Well, I think back to the 70s and that time that Richard Barnett was writing about. And in those days, I was a young hippie, and I lived a very energy-efficient life. And it was a combination of politics and outlook, and also I didn't have the money to spend on those kinds of things. But I keep looking back at that and thinking about the kind of models. It's a little hard when you get really used to driving everywhere to remember, you know, oh, I can bicycle and I can walk. But what do you think it will take individuals as, I mean, because I think it needs to come from both places. It needs to come from individuals, and also needs to come from government and from industry.
That's right.
So how do we all work together so that we really change our outlook about what is a good life?
Well, it helps if we're all on the same page, if we all understand that this is where we're headed, where we need to head, and how we need to plan. For individuals, you know, an energy-efficient lifestyle can be really exciting. I know my wife Janet and I have been doing this for some time now, and we grow quite a lot of our own food. We have chickens in the backyard and solar panels on the roof and all the rest. We couldn't do it overnight. It took years of work to do these things, but we're so happy with our lifestyle as a result. You know, we're involved in our own food. The chickens are a part of our lives, and we don't worry about power bills. So if for individuals to start thinking along these lines is great, but you know, it's also really important for communities and for, you know, larger government institutions to start planning along these lines to make it easier for people to do these things. When we plan cities, you know, why are we building more highways? That's the transport mode of the 20th century. We have to be thinking about neighborhoods and making it so that people don't have to be transported so far in order to go shopping or go to work. And that's really where the payoff is going to be when we begin thinking systemically about how to reduce energy consumption.
Well, Richard, I wish we had more time to talk because I feel like we're just scratching the surface. But fortunately, I'll be talking with other of your co-writers about this book in the next few weeks. So we're going to be continuing this conversation, and it'd be nice to have you back sometime and talk some more.
Be happy to do that.
Well, thanks a whole lot. We've been talking with Richard Heimberg of Peak Oil fame, and he's the author of a couple articles that are in a new book called Energy Overdevelopment and the Delusion of Endless Growth. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website. And for now, you need to just go to kboo.fm and in the search panel on the upper right hand corner, type in Locus Focus and either the date of the show, or you could just type in energy or Richard Heimberg, and you will get to the show. And hopefully within a few weeks, we'll be able to have our page back where all the shows are just up and it'll be much easier to find things. Next week, we'll be continuing this discussion about curbing our energy appetite. We're going to have Tom Butler on, who's the editor of this book, Energy. I'm Barbara Bernstein. My engineer is Carlos Chavez. We're going to go out with some music by the band. Thanks for listening.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud media sponsor of Organicology, the Northwest's largest gathering of the organic food trade. Study the organic industry and shape the future of sustainable eating. February 7th through 9th at the Hilton, 921 Southwest 6th Avenue in Portland. Again, that's Organicology, February 7th through 9th. More information can be found at kboo.fm/organic2013.
It's a new year, and Black History Month is now upon us to reflect the issues unique to Black African peoples. Join me, Sequoyna Wright, a KBOO volunteer regular, every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. for the month of February, starting February 2nd, as I discuss with special guests Tariq Nasheed, Dr. Umar Johnson, Dr. Claude Anderson, and my very own father about the present state of Black America. Topics include love and relationships, mental health, music, and economics. Tune in and join in on the conversation on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. I know it's all.
loves her daddy's dome, trying to think of what you want.
KBOO Radio is proud to help Zippity News and a clothes drive to help clothe the homeless. We will be collecting gloves, hats, and scarves until February 15th, when the clothes will be distributed throughout the homeless community. KBOO is located on 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, just off Burnside. Thank you, and we hope to see you donating clothes to help keep the homeless warm this winter.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Alma Midwifery, offering prenatal care, home and birth center birth, and mother-baby care for the first 6 weeks postpartum. Alma Midwifery provides relationship-based care with certified nurse and professional midwives, as well as childbirth education, yoga, and parenting classes, located in the heart of Portland at Southeast 16th and Ankeny, or almamidwifery.com.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Why, even as medicine improves, are we becoming less healthy? Why are American women dying in childbirth more now than 10 years ago? Why do we grow fatter the more we diet? Why have so many attempts to save the environment backfired? These are some of the questions that journalist Nathaniel Johnson explores in his book, All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest to Discover If the Natural Approach to Diet, Childbirth, Healing, and the Environment Really Keeps Us Healthier and Happier. Nathaniel Johnson is an award-winning journalist who has written features for Harper's, New York, and Outside Magazine, and produced stories for National Public Radio and This American Life. He studied with Michael Pollan at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. He's here today on Health Watch and also at Powell's on Hawthorne on Thursday night. Welcome to Health Watch, Nathaniel Johnson.
Oh, it's so great to be here.
Well, let's start with we mentioned all these conundrums that are in All Natural, and you sort of frame the conundrums around a tension that exists between nature and technology, and trying to parse out